Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. Assalamu alaikum. So in this session, my objective is to examine the state of economic empowerment of Muslim women, what role religion versus other factors plays in determining that status. So as you can see from the outline, I'll focus on the drivers of and barriers to women's labor participation. So beyond the gender equity argument and women's rights to decide whether they want to participate in the market or not, the economic cost of gender inequality in labor markets is high. So countries are losing $160 trillion in wealth because of differences in lifetime earnings between women and men. In MENA, the Middle East and North Africa region, the losses are at $3.1 trillion, which represents 7.4% of the base regional wealth. If women played the same role in labor markets as men, as much as $28 trillion could be added to the global GDP by 2025, according to a projection of McKinsey back in 2015. In the MENA region, gender equality in labor market would increase the GDP of the average country by 60%. However, we see that in the Muslim world, women or Muslim women are lagging behind in terms of women's economic participation. We have more than 800 million Muslim women who are living in 45 Muslim majority countries and in more than 30 countries with significant Muslim minority population, just to provide the scope of the population we're talking about. Muslims are the fastest growing religious group in the world. So these figures are likely to increase in the near future. Women are now the majority of university students in the Muslim world. They are also represent a great market. Accounting for all the women, Muslim women's earnings, they represent $1 trillion market. 15 million women have joined the workforce, and I'm here talking about the Muslim majority countries, for the first time in the turn of the millennium. Yet again, female labor force participation, despite these important advances that should be highlighted, female labor force participation in majority Muslim countries lag behind that in non-Muslim countries. However, the Muslim world is not a monolithic body, but comprised of a different set of economies, cultures, and geographies, which is reflected in the variation in female labor force participation across majority Muslim countries. So as we can see from this table, a sample of majority Muslim countries from different parts of the world, the Middle East and North Africa, and also Southeast Asia and other areas, we see that some majority Muslim countries, Indonesia, for instance, which hosts the world's largest Muslim population, female labor force participation is 53% as a percentage of population ages 15 plus. Compared to, it's the same rate in OECD members. The same for Malaysia, the same rate as OECD members. We see, however, in some countries in the Middle East and North Africa, Egypt, Iran, Morocco, and Tunisia and other countries that are not in the table, female labor force participation is very low. In other countries, the United Arab Emirates, for instance, it's even higher than OECD members, 55. The rate of women's participation in the labor force in Kazakhstan is 65. But we need to make a difference between the two countries, and we need to look into the gender gap, because it's not sufficient to only consider female labor force participation without comparing it to men's economic participation. So we see that despite the high rate in the UAE, the gender gap is still significant, given the initially high participation rate of men, which means that there's still room for more women to participate in the labor force. In Kazakhstan has the lowest gender gap in female labor, labor force participation. So what are the drivers of female labor force participation? women's work is posited to be related to development, to economic development, through the process of economic transformation. Hence the relationship between female labor force participation and GDP per capita globally. So levels of female labor force participation are high, or tend to be high, for the poorest countries generally, where agriculture is the dominant sector and women often participate in smallholder agricultural work. Women's participation in the workforce in lower middle-income countries, which have much smaller shares of agricultural activities, tends to be lower. Finally, among high-income countries, female labor force participation is again higher, accompanied by a shift towards a service sector-based economy and higher education among women. This theory of the U-shape, as I said, highest level of participation in low-income countries, then low in low and middle-income countries, then high again in high-income countries. So hence the U-shape theory is observed globally across countries of different income levels. But this global picture may be misleading, as more recent studies have found this pattern does not hold within region or when looking within a specific country over time. So as we see here, in no region do we observe a U-shape pattern in female participation and GDP per capita over the past three decades. Sorry, no, please go to previous slides. This one, yeah, this one. So here we see all the regions represented. There's no U-shape over the last three decades. We don't observe any U-shaped pattern in female participation in GDP per capita. Can we? Next. So within the country, as we observe trajectories of different countries, as you can see over there, Panama, Portugal, Korea, Republic of Korea, Spain, and Chile, so for their GDP per capita evolution, we observe some countries' GDP per capita in the 1960, for instance, Chile, is comparable to all low and middle income economies highlighted in the blue band. So if we see Chile, where Chile, the starting point, that was 1960, we see that it's the same, that it corresponds or overlaps with today's GDP per GDP per capita on the countries on the blue band, including Indonesia, for instance. However, most of these economies, again including Indonesia and all the Vietnam and what else, Mongolia, Eswatini, and so forth, El Salvador, have higher female labor force participation today than Chile did at similar income levels in 1960. This suggests that the relationship of female labor force participation to GDP for lower income countries today is different than was the case decades ago. This tells us the importance of accounting for other factors, changing social norms, demographics, technology, urbanization, to name a few. So this U-shape theory does not hold at a regional level, does not hold within the country as their GDP per capita progresses with time. It doesn't hold in at this national level either. So what are the barriers to women's economic participation in some majority Muslim countries? Here is a summary of these factors as put forward by the literature, and then I will provide my own summary. So some researchers consider the low female participation rates in Islamic countries as a direct impact of religion. There are many studies on that particular point. Some consider geographical conditions and historical understanding, some social norms and traditions, wrong interpretation of religion, low economic development levels. So we see different factors highlighted by the literature. Based on the mentioned literature, international reports, World Bank's reports, OECD, WEF, and so forth, and national studies, barriers to female economic participation could be structured, in my view, around four different buckets. The legal institutional framework, social norms and structural inequalities, human capital, and economic growth and opportunities. In the rest of my presentation, I'll briefly... No, could you go up? Yeah, this one, yeah. So in the rest of my presentation, I'll briefly discuss each of these four points. So the legal and institutional framework, and this comprises or refers to legal as legal provisions restricting women's employment in certain sectors and jobs, in labor codes and regulations of many Muslim-majority countries, example, Iran. The law, the labor code, prohibits women from working in jobs or undertaking jobs deemed dangerous and industrial jobs. Those restrictions or this type of restrictions does not exist in Indonesia, for instance. In Tunisia, women are prohibited from being employed in the mining sector and some agricultural jobs. The same for Morocco, mining and extractive sectors. And the list is long. I just wanted to provide a few examples. Second, we also have legal provisions restricting women's agency in personal status laws and penal codes. And my friend, Dr. Azima, am I getting it right, mentioned that in her presentation, the rule of some legal restrictions. So example of legal restrictions legal restrictions undermining women's agency, Iran again, mobility restrictions in the personal status law, prohibiting women from traveling abroad or going outside the home without the husband's permission, which undermines their economic participation. And if you've been following the news, you must have seen a lot of articles about champions in different sports who could not leave the country to participate in championships in other countries because their husbands did not let them go. So these interpretations or these provisions are actually based on religious interpretations of concepts such as guardianship or such as qiwama. Not sure how to translate this one, but these religious concepts are used in the interpretation of these concepts are used to shape different legal provisions. Same in Iraq, for instance, where the penal code allows the husband to discipline, aka beat, his wife for the purpose of disciplining her. And the provision is written with these exact words. In Saudi Arabia, there used to be mobility restrictions on women who could not have their own passports. Their passports used to be a page in their husband's passports, which was a restriction which was lifted only in 2019. In Turkey, different type of restriction, but still it is the other extreme, the veiled restriction up until 2013, when veiled women were not allowed to work in government buildings, were not allowed to study, basically to go to university if they were wearing a veil, which was proven to have had major impacts on women's economic participation and also on women's education, which also has an impact eventually, which had an impact eventually on their economic participation. Okay, the last type of legal restriction is category of legal restrictions is the lack or correspond to the lack of legislation policies leveling the playing field and enabling women's employment and entrepreneurship. Women have, for instance, limited access to property, which means limited collateral. They cannot have the same access to finance, the same access to loans as men. So the lack of policies accounting for this, the lack of gender-sensitive policies accounting for these structural inequalities, accounting for these unequal starting points for both men and women, lead also to undermining women's economic participation, women's entrepreneurship in that case. The second bucket main key factor driving women's economic participation is the social norms and structural inequalities. And here we talk about the gender roles, meaning pressures to confirm, man being perceived as primary breadwinners, marital status, which is which often restricts women's freedom. It also encompasses patriarchal hierarchical structures, not only in family settings, but also in workplaces and other institutions, perceptions of masculinity and femininity, exceptions on how women should dress, should behave with men, and perceptions of power. Many empirical studies, including one that analyzes differences between Muslims and non-Muslims in Australia, for instance, show that family structures and conditions, including the existence of infants and the age of the youngest child, plus the household stock of human capital, especially education, have much stronger effects on female participation rates than religious differences. Which will take us now to the third bucket, or the third point, which is human capital. And here I primarily focus on education. Women's education and other factors related to their family conditions, as I said, was proven to be correlated with, more strongly correlated with their economic participation, more than the religious factor. Among those aged 25 and 23, Muslims have the lowest, it's really an important point, average years of schooling among major religious groups, at 6.7 years compared to a global average of 8.6. Muslim, and here I'm talking about Muslim women in the last point. So there is a significant gender gap in education, with an average of 4.9 for women years of schooling versus 6.4 for men. And the largest gap, again, it's variant across the Muslim world. The largest gap is in the Middle East and North Africa. The last bucket, economic growth and opportunities, which gets undermined by low levels of investment in opportunities in many Muslim majority countries, which means less job opportunities for everyone, including women, and friendly environments for businesses, undermining overall employment, including women's. So high taxes, complicated administrative requirements, corruption, and political instability make it hard for people, for domestic investors and foreign investors, to create job opportunities. And lastly, and diversified economy due to abundant natural resources, which is specific to the Middle East and North Africa. And here I would like to further analyze the last point, as it provides a great example of how different factors interplay with each other. Geographic context, economic growth and opportunities, legal and institutional framework and social norms, but not religion, interestingly. So what is the effect of oil or natural resources on female labor force participation and political influence eventually? Ross argues that the traditional inclusion of women into low wage and low tech employment, specifically manufacturing, has been impossible in petrostates that skipped over the manufacturing industrialization process. This has blocked the path of women's political and economic empowerment. So we can see here that rising oil production leads to drop in traded goods and increase in non-traded goods, which is referred to as the Dutch disease. What do we mean by traded goods? So traded goods or traded sectors refer mostly to agricultural sectors and export-oriented industries, which are more women-friendly, which are likely to employ women. The increase in non-traded sectors, which is construction, for instance, and retail, which are more likely to employ men. So the increase in non-traded sectors leads to even higher male wages, the drop in traded goods to lower female wages. Again, the rise in oil also leads to more government transfers to buy political support, which further reinforces the traditional model of the man being the primary breadwinner. Higher female and earned income or alternative income, meaning that women without having to work outside the home have income through their husbands, their husbands or fathers or any other male relatives, higher wages, and lower female wages as a result of the drop in traded goods. These all lead to lower female labor force participation. So we can see here the interplay between the legal framework, the social norms, the segregational the occupational segregation, where are women expected to work, and so forth. The interplay of all these factors that have led to lower female labor participation. The geography, of course, and economic opportunities created by the rise in oil production. So, some takeaways from this presentation. One, I think some of the theories explaining what drives female labor force participation should be analyzed carefully based on the context in question of the country in question. The Muslim world, again, the Muslim world is not a monolithic body. Different barriers undermine women's economic empowerment in different contexts. Religion is not the culprit responsible for low female labor force participation in some Muslim-majority countries. However, the role of religious interpretations in shaping social norms and legal institutional frameworks should be accounted for. Multiple barriers interplay with each other and factor into low stagnant or stagnant female labor force participation in some majority Muslim countries. Last but not least, it is important to consider all of these different drivers and barriers when analyzing female labor force participation in the Muslim world. Thank you so much.